on the absurdity of some of the threats I read as a Secret Service agent. It doesn't require serious intellectual capacity to type up an outrageous threat. This has caused the Secret Service innumerable headaches. They live in a zero-error environment where they cannot skip an investigation on a threat case, whether snail-mailed, emailed, tweeted, or Facebooked. But as a matter of simple logistics, they cannot possibly interview every person who takes advantage of social media to threaten the president. Complicating matters for the Secret Service is President Trump's personal use of Twitter. While I cannot conclusively show that President Trump is the person physically tapping the keyboard and pressing send for each tweet on his account, the evidence suggests that he personally monitors and uses the account. Dan Scavino Jr., President Trump's director of social media, confirmed this in an April 2017 interview with the Fox News Network. There's a pattern to his recurrent tweets, evidenced by his use of punctuation, capitalization, and wording, that strongly suggests that he is the person sending many of the tweets. Unfortunately, this has fed the public perception that if he is the one sending the tweets, then someone wishing to threaten him can send him a tweet in response. This has led to an enormous number of threatening tweets, directed both at Trump, using his Twitter handle, and in response to his own tweets. The Secret Service does not have the manpower required to handle this volume of social media tweets. They will have to evolve with the changing rules for social media usage, because Trump has reset the rules for what the president or presidential candidate can do on Twitter. How are political consultants going to reasonably tell their presidential candidates and future presidential campaigns that active, personal engagement on the platform is a strategic loser, given Trump's tremendous success doing precisely that? And since sending a Secret Service agent out in the field to investigate every Twitter threat, the volume of which is likely to explode in future campaigns, isn't a plausible option. The question is, what can they do? This will be uncomfortable for the Secret Service, but they are going to have to partner up with local law enforcement on PI cases. PI stands for Protective Intelligence, what I've been referring to as a threat case, and the Secret Service takes PI cases so seriously that every PI case is managed out of a headquarters division exclusively dedicated to PI case management. The management of the Secret Service has always feared turning over the management of PI cases to the field offices because the investigation of a presidential threat is an elaborate process within the Secret Service. And when a PI case is opened, it is difficult to close. Because of this elaborate administrative process, Secret Service headquarters was concerned that managers in Secret Service field offices would avoid opening PI cases to escape the massive mound of paperwork required to close these cases if they turn out to be false alarms. But this PI case investigation and management process was designed for an older era, when snail-mailed threats were relatively rare and phoned-in threats from landlines were easy to locate. In this new era of difficult-to-track email and social media threats, the Secret Service is going to have to abandon this headquarters-centric approach to managing PI cases. They are going to have to turn control of these cases over to the Secret Service field offices, and the local Secret Service field offices will have to partner with local law enforcement to appropriately investigate these cases. The model for this isn't new. The Secret Service already does this with counterfeit currency cases. Counterfeiting U.S. currency, although limited in scope, isn't rare enough for the Secret Service to be able to run every case into the investigative ground. Therefore, to prosecute counterfeiters, the Secret Service works with local and state law enforcement on smaller counterfeiting cases to prosecute them through the local and state systems. The Secret Service would be well suited to provide sophisticated training to local and state partners in order to move forward with a partnership on PI cases. There would likely be enormous managerial pushback from the Secret Service because of the fear of local law enforcement misdiagnosing a threat case. a potential attack that could have been prevented. But this is the only palatable choice they have. Unless the Secret Service plans on hiring tens of thousands of additional agents to investigate every late-night Twitter threat directed at the president, their choices are, one, pick and choose which threats to investigate, or two, decentralize the PI investigative model and train and trust local and state partners to help on PI cases. Chapter 9. Temporary Protection Agents, the Wow Factor, and White House Staff Ass-Kissing. The special agent manpower crisis in the Secret Service has caused a cascade of problems throughout the agency. One of those problems became headline news in March 2017, when it was widely reported that two Secret Service agents, while transporting President Trump's 8-year-old grandson, Donald Trump III, snapped a selfie with him while he was sleeping in the back of a vehicle the agents were driving. Trump's grandson awoke in the middle of the photo, and his parents, Donald Trump Jr. and Vanessa Trump, were understandably disturbed by the incident. "I was employed as an agent for over a decade, and I have taken many photos with protectees, some at their request, some as a courtesy to PPD agents, and some taken by members of the media. But I cannot fathom why two adults, trained as Secret Service agents and charged with securing the life of an 8-year-old boy, would think it was appropriate to snap a selfie with a sleeping child. The creepy factor in this story is extraordinary. And when the story became public, a number of current agents I keep in contact with relayed to me that even the most forgiving agents were repulsed by the story. Most Secret Service agents are parents first, and many of them felt that this wasn't only an abdication of the agent's official duties, it was an embarrassment to the agency and the people working within it. But with the manpower crisis in the Secret Service, this event, however creepy, is explainable. The Secret Service's two largest permanent protection details, the Presidential Protective Division, PPD, and the Vice Presidential Protective Division, VPPD, are difficult assignments for agents to get. Contrary to public perception, most of the Secret Service's special agents are not assigned to these protection details. Most Secret Service agent staff are assigned to investigative field offices. Due to their preference for experienced agents only, it takes a Secret Service agent anywhere from 7 to 10 years of above-average performance in his or her investigative field office assignment before that agent is eligible for reassignment to either the PPD or VPPD protection detail. This limits the pool of agents eligible for these assignments for a couple of reasons. First, not every agent assigned to a field office will be an above-average performer. Above-average would obviously be meaningless if there weren't an accompanying group of below-average performers in the field offices. Many of these below-average performing agents will be assigned to positions in intelligence on the Dignitary Protective Division, or they will remain in the field office throughout their careers because no other division of the Secret Service will accept them. Second, the manpower crisis on both the uniformed division side of the Secret Service and on the special agent side has caused the Secret Service to hemorrhage mid-career officers and agents. This phenomenon is especially prevalent during the busy presidential election campaign seasons, where younger agents, hired in the years immediately preceding a presidential campaign, and with no experience in dealing with the rigors of arduous work weeks on the campaign trail, leave the Secret Service relatively early in their young careers because of the shock of the campaign workload. Note, the Secret Service has hidden some of their shocking attrition numbers in the past by classifying agents who leave for employment in other federal agencies as transfers rather than resignations. As is the case with the uniformed division officers, many of the older, veteran special agents have invested so much of their lives into the Secret Service that it becomes an indispensable part of their identity, and they stay with the agency, not wishing to start over later in life with another federal law enforcement agency. This leaves the Secret Service with a noticeable experience gap of mid-career agents eligible to be assigned to the PPD and the VPPD who are both still young enough to physically perform at an elite level in the protection mission and experienced enough to avoid being prone to the wow factor. The wow factor in the Secret Service doesn't fit into a simple descriptive box, but most agents who have served any appreciable period of time in the Secret Service have experienced it. It's that feeling that younger, less experienced agents get the first time they do fill in the blank as an agent. I left the space blank because the Secret Service is so full of incredible experiences that I used to joke with people that it was the closest thing to being famous without anyone knowing who you are. Most Secret Service agents have vivid memories of the first time the President of the United States walked by their post in the White House, or the first time they stood post outside of the Oval Office, or the first time they boarded either Air Force One or Marine One. Being a Secret Service agent is a job full of amazing firsts. I remember my first day assigned to the White House on the PPD as if it were just yesterday. I recall standing outside of the Oval Office on an afternoon shift for the first time and being overwhelmed by the fact that if, God forbid, something were to happen to President George W. Bush during the time I was assigned the Oval Office post, I was expected to act quickly, decisively, and without any hesitation to either save the president or remove the threat. It really hits you like a blast of cold air after leaving a warm shower when you are first turned loose as a new agent on the PPD. The gravity of what you've been trained to do slams you in the face as you're posted in front of the Oval Office. And if you're as fascinated by politics as I was at the time, you can't process all of the information as people you've only come to know from their talking heads on the cable news channels walk by you and say hello. I was impressed in my early days on the PPD how friendly everyone in the George W. Bush White House was to the Secret Service. It took a few months for the, "Who's that guy? I know I've seen him on TV," internal questioning to wear off. Sometimes I would see a familiar face from Congress in the White House, and I would recognize the face, but I couldn't recall the person's name. The irony was that many of the newer members of Congress who were at the White House for the first time appeared to have the same, "Wow, I can't believe I'm here," look on their faces as some of the new agents to the PPD did. The wow factor is generally strongest while at the White House, as the awe, the building, its history, and its prior occupants inspires is breathtaking. During my first overnight shift at the White House, I remember walking through the state floor on the East Wing side and thinking about how many presidents and dignitaries had walked this exact path, and the dramatic domestic and global crises they must have been trying to mentally power through as they took each step on the echo-prone and cavernous state floor. Memories of my first trips on both Air Force One and Marine One also had a wow factor. Although my first trip on Air Force One was a short one, less than an hour of flight time, I still remember walking up the back staircase of the plane and thinking that I was surely being mistaken for someone else. I couldn't fathom that I was doing what I was actually doing, even though I had been a special agent for nearly a decade at that point. I also remember the first time I flew aboard Marine One with President Obama. We were flying in the smaller UH-60 Blackhawk version of Marine One, and the quarters were extremely cramped, but it was still a breathtaking moment. Flying in the helicopters in the Secret Service, whether aboard Marine One or on the support helicopters, is visually stunning because it looks like a motorcade in the sky. I remember flying by the Hollywood sign in Los Angeles as a passenger aboard one of the birds and thinking that I couldn't imagine doing anything else. It's as if the Secret Service agent position is two entirely different jobs. First, you're asked to be a cop, hunting down criminal counterfeiters and fraudsters, and then you're thrust into the world's most sensitive power centers with the most powerful people on the planet, and you're told not to be a cop, but to be a diplomat, a security agent, and a psychologist. Despite what the Secret Service management continues to publicly state, in order to hold on to the investigative mission, again, largely due to the potential for post-retirement positions in the financial sector, which the Secret Service is charged with investigating as part of its financial crimes investigations. These two missions require entirely different skill sets, with very little overlap. Some of the field agents who excel at criminal investigations go on to become below-average protection agents, and vice versa. My initial experiences and the accompanying emotions surrounding them in the White House, aboard Air Force One and aboard Marine One, are all examples of the wow factor. My sincere apologies for the ridiculous name, but there really is no sophisticated way to describe it. These experiences are emotionally overwhelming at first, even for the most experienced special agents newly assigned to the protection details, and it takes years to learn to treat the PPD as a job, rather than an experience. I know this may seem odd to the outside observer because most people have only seen the Secret Service on television, and they are accustomed to seeing their stone faces devoid of emotion and hidden behind dark sunglasses. But this is a fantasy no different from a Hollywood movie filmed near the Hollywood sign, I Flew Over Aboard Marine One. Despite their stern, calm, and collected external demeanor, most of the agents on the PPD and VPPD, with the exception of a handful of senior agents, who've been on the detail for years, are self-aware of the magnanimity of the task they are doing, and how special it is that they are doing it. Likewise, those agents are also aware of the penalties for screwing up the mission. This is why the wow factor is so dangerous to the protection operations of the Secret Service. Every moment spent deliberating on how amazing what you're doing is, or how someone at home might see you on TV performing your job. Note, I was not at all above this in my initial years on the PPD, therefore I personally know the dangers of it. Is a moment you may be distracted from observing a suspicious person in a crowd on a presidential rope line. Experience is a game changer on the PPD, and it takes years on the PPD to learn how to drown out the external stimulation surrounding the president, and to focus exclusively on the protection task at hand. Yet, this is where the Secret Service has another glaring malignancy. The loss of many mid-career agents to other federal agencies, due to the relocation requirements for agents, and the agent salary cap in the Secret Service, combined with the large size of President Trump's family, who all fall under the PPD protective umbrella, has created another manpower crisis within the PPD, with no end in sight. The agents assigned to protect the grandson of President Trump on that day in March 2017 were temporarily assigned to the detail from the field offices. They were not experienced members of the PPD. Even with newer and less experienced agents assigned to the protective details, there's still an "I can't believe I'm here" component. And although the two temporarily assigned agents unquestionably should have known better, they were probably thinking about how exciting it was to be protecting members of the first family. I am in no way apologizing for their behavior. I am simply trying to explain why two adult Secret Service agents would think it was a good idea to snap a selfie with a sleeping youngster. I included the wow factor in this book about fixing the problems within the Secret Service, not simply to discuss why a few agents took an inappropriate selfie, but also because this is at the core of a dangerous training deficit within the Secret Service. Being a new member of the PPD, or the VPPD, is an intimidating experience when agents first arrive, and learning how to speak up when you see something going wrong is a learned skill. It can be intimidating when an agent first arrives on the detail to tell a senior member of the president's advisory team, or a member of Congress, that he or she cannot enter the president's holding room, a room designated for the president where he can relax before or after a speech or event. The Secret Service is aware of the problem, and as a result, they assign new agents to the PPD to the press agent role for the presidential security shift, because that's the position with the least amount of responsibility. The press agent has to ensure that the press stays clean, meaning free of weapons and explosives after the security sweeps. And, candidly, It's also the position farthest away from the president on a protective movement, where a less experienced PPD agent can do the least amount of damage if he or she shits the bed. Agent jargon for panicking when something goes wrong. But spending multiple shifts as the press agent is not enough training to wear down the wow factor to a degree that a PPD agent can function, agnostic of his high-octane surroundings. The PPD and the VPPD are currently so dramatically undermanned that fully staffed protection mission training has become a rarity. The White House is a ghost town during presidential domestic and foreign travel, and it's a travesty that during these times, the Secret Service isn't using the facility for intense protection training. It may surprise you to learn that in the nearly 5 years I was assigned to the White House as a PPD agent, I didn't tactically train on the White House facility even once. Even worse, in that nearly 5 year period, I never once saw the inside of the residence on the East Wing side of the White House. Think about that. I was a number one whip on the PPD, a non-supervisory position, but one that places you in charge of the president's protection shift while you're working at the White House. And I never saw the inside of the residence I was expected to respond to if there was an emergency involving the president. I had only seen maps of what the inside of the White House residence looked like. Talk about a wow factor. Can you fathom having to wake the president at night during a dangerous intrusion into the White House as the working whip and having to look at a map of the presidential residence to find your way around while seeing the president and first lady's sleeping quarters for the first time? To do this seamlessly and without hesitation, these maneuvers should be drilled repeatedly, over and over until the movements become instincts. This is the Secret Service. It isn't bouncing at the local bar. Every decision an agent makes in the Secret Service in a real emergency is going to be scrutinized in perpetuity, and every agent on the PPD knows it. If you make a mistake as a bar bouncer breaking up a fight in your bar, and it turns out it's really just two friends messing around, it's no big deal, and the world doesn't really care. But if you're a Secret Service agent who has never seen the inside of the White House residence, and you're in charge of evacuating the president when multiple armed terrorists with explosives and heavy weapons start jumping the White House fence, and you turn left instead of right in the residence because the president got up to use the bathroom, then you just changed the entire course of world history. Local bars and bartenders don't have a wow factor, and the penalties for the bouncer screwing up in the circumstances I described are painless. But being a Secret Service agent means being surrounded constantly by high-octane emotion, majesty, and history that can be a powerful emotional distraction and can paralyze even the most seasoned agent with thoughts of the devastating consequences of taking the wrong action in an emergency. This can only be overcome with consistent, rigorous, on-site training of very specific responses to emergencies, which can override the emotions of the moment of attack and allow the agents to effectively operate and maneuver in the physiological red zone. You may be curious why Secret Service management hasn't prioritized the training necessary to drill into their PPD agents the proper emergency responses at the White House. There are a couple of factors at play here. First, the manpower crisis within the Secret Service has rippled throughout the PPD and VPPD, and the constant search for personnel has forced them to assign temporary agents to the PPD, as was the case in the infamous Donald Trump III selfie debacle. This has severely curtailed the time allotted for training among the agents permanently assigned to the PPD and the VPPD. In a perfect world, PPD agents work 2 weeks of morning shifts, 2 weeks of evening shifts, 2 weeks of midnight shifts, and 2 weeks of training. But this perfect world rarely materializes because the management of the Secret Service, due to workforce constraints, doesn't prioritize the 2 weeks of assigned training. Agents on their 2 week training rotation are routinely taken off of training assignments to conduct both in-towns, presidential security advances in the Washington, D.C. area, and out-of-town advances, and the training is rarely made up. Compounding the training deficit is that the best advance agents are typically in high demand because of their ability to handle difficult situations on security advances. Therefore, these agents are routinely taken off of training to do advance work, and as a result, many of the best agents, ironically, rarely train. At the tail end of my PPD career, I was assigned to a number of lead advances, and as an advance advisor, coaching a first-time lead advance, so often that I found it difficult to find the time to perform even basic training, such as my mandatory monthly shooting requirement with my service pistol. I gave up trying to do it during work or training hours due to the never-ending travel, and I started shooting during those increasingly rare off days. This infuriated my wife, but it kept me out of the PPD supervisor's office. Even when PPD agents are permitted to train, the training rarely happens on-site at the White House. This is inexcusable and is largely due to the fact that the Secret Service management in headquarters is risk-averse and does everything in its power to avoid conflict that might damage their promotional potential or post-retirement work plans. Fighting for training time on the White House complex would ruffle some White House staff feathers because it would alter their work schedules, and it would alter the White House tour schedule for their friends and families. But it's absurd that Secret Service headquarters isn't making a strong push for it. It's not entirely surprising that this fight for White House access isn't happening. The culture of the PPD imbues its agents with an unnecessary and dangerous sense of submissiveness to the White House staff, which carries over as the working agents become headquarters managers themselves. The Secret Service could push the issue with the White House staff to allow it to conduct regular exercises within the White House, but that would disrupt the White House social calendar. When you've learned to do everything in your power to avoid conflict with the White House staff and be subservient, these are fights few Secret Service managers are willing to initiate, even though the lack of on-site training is one of the reasons behind the recent security failures at the White House. I expect none of this will change until the Secret Service cleans house at the headquarters level and the DHS brings in outside eyes to see the training shortcomings currently staring the Secret Service in the face. Or, heaven forbid, a trained terrorist team of White House assailants successfully breaches the White House and has to be removed by a military special weapons team. I suspect that in the congressional testimony in the aftermath of such a devastating attack, it will be revealed that many of the agents on duty that day were never even offered the opportunity to train on the actual White House grounds they pledged their lives to defend. Subservience to the White House staff was a hallmark of the Secret Service's PPD while I was on the detail. The obsequious behavior of the PPD management is not a natural trait inherent in most of the working agents on the PPD. Rather, it's drilled into them by a Secret Service management class primarily concerned with conflict avoidance, not in always doing what's in the best interests of presidential security. It was strange working on the PPD because on the smaller issues that would pop up on security advances, I was always backed up by PPD management when the White House staff and I had conflicting views on how a presidential security plan should be implemented. But on the larger issues, such as the visibility of the Secret Service Special Weapons Team, CAT, the Counter Assault Team, which is the Secret Service's version of a SWAT operation, and the distance between the Secret Service agents and the President, the White House staff was constantly asking us to stand farther away from the President than we were comfortable doing in order to keep the cameras from picking up the agents, again, to make the President appear more approachable, the Secret Service would consistently lose the fight. The world saw the results of the White House staff's "keep the agents away from the president" cries during the infamous shoe-throwing incident during President George W. Bush's December 2008 trip to Iraq. I was working in the Washington, D.C.-based PPD Joint Operations Center, JOC, when the incident happened, and as the team at the JOC watched it unbelievably unfold, On the many television monitors inside the old dank and cramped Joint Operations Center, we were in disbelief. Of course, the phone started ringing off the hooks in the JOC in the immediate aftermath of the incident, with Secret Service upper management looking for answers as to what happened. But we only knew what they knew from watching the television, because it had just happened. The working PPD supervisor that day was one of the finest men I ever worked with in the Secret Service. He was a noble man with a warrior's heart. I know that when he looks back on that incident, he wishes he'd been closer to the president than he was. But it wasn't his fault. The White House staff were obsessed with getting Secret Service agents out of the shot. That is, away from the view of the TV cameras. Think about the insanity of this position. President Bush was in one of the most dangerous countries in the world for an American president to be in, Iraq, and the staff still wanted agents out of view. I'm hoping someone close to our current president reads about this silliness and asks the president himself to squash this potentially deadly stay-out-of-the-shot nonsense before someone else gets hurt or embarrassed. Sadly, many of the PPD agents doing advance work knew that the management wouldn't back them up in a pissing match with the staff about these larger issues. So most of these fights were over before they started, because agents just refused to fight them. This constant battering by the White House staff in the back-and-forth battle between presidential security demands and presidential approachability optics had a powerful psychological effect on the agents of the PPD when I was there, as they learned to succumb to an informal hierarchy in the White House, where the PPD agents, unfortunately, are near the bottom. After years on the PPD, some of the agents learned to fight back and win many of these approachability versus security fights, but most of them do not. Also, many of the winners are unfairly labeled troublemakers. This tone is set early in a PPD agent's tenure on the detail, and it is always set by the staff. With such a heavy responsibility for setting the tone for how the presidential bubble, the White House staff, the White House military office, the White House communications agency, and the Secret Service should conduct itself and represent the White House when the president is traveling, a reasonable person would expect that the White House staff would act as an example for the other members of the bubble, the Secret Service included. When I left Barack Obama's presidential detail in December 2010, it was a poorly kept secret that people within his closest of inner circles had not only failed to set the proper tone for the behavior of the personnel within the presidential bubble, but had acted inappropriately on a number of foreign trips themselves. The behavior that the White House staff were engaging in during the Obama administration could have easily jeopardized our national security by putting sensitive information in the hands of suspicious foreign actors who may have been targeting these Obama staff insiders. But rather than stopping this behavior by confronting the protectee or the White House staff, members of the bubble accommodated it, and Secret Service management ignored it to avoid conflict with the staff, as if these people are earthly gods to be worshipped and never questioned. The election of Donald Trump was a loud message to the Washington, D.C. elites that the American people were tired of this two-tiered system. But the power of the bubble is strong, and it reinforces this double standard of behavior. Many of the Secret Service lead advance agents on overseas presidential trips quietly knew to have a late-night access plan ready in case these Obama administration staff insiders returned back to the presidential hotel late in the night and in the early morning with people unfamiliar to the advance team. I've never spoken publicly of this before, but I, along with a number of PPD agents I worked with, found it deeply troubling that many of the same Obama administration staff insiders, who knew about the worst behavioral offenders within the Obama inner circle and spent time with them overseas, were quick to attack the nascent Donald Trump administration in its early days for suspicious ties to the Russian government, with little evidence backing up those claims. These former Obama insiders exhibited the worst kind of hypocrisy on Twitter, calling out the Trump administration and putting them under an artificial cloud of suspicion, when many of these Obama acolytes knew about the recklessness and carelessness that happened overseas when their friends were occupying the White House. I suspect many of the PPD agents who served during this same time period know exactly what I'm referring to regarding the reckless overseas behavior of many of President Obama's closest staff members, and many of them were bothered by it at the time. After the fence-jumping incidents and the Secret Service scandal in Colombia, it's public knowledge that the Secret Service has had its own share of problems overseas, and I'm in no way suggesting that the special agents of the Secret Service are free from sin, me included. Human beings make human mistakes, and the agents and officers involved in the fence-jumping incidents and the overseas scandals were punished severely. Two of the officers involved in the 2017 fence-jumping incident were fired by the Secret Service not long after the incident for their mistakes, along with being publicly and privately humiliated within the Secret Service. Their careers and their lives were never the same after their mistakes. But what happened to the Obama insiders who engaged in equally troubling behavior? Nothing happened to them. Their reckless behavior, the kind that would have cost lower-level White House staff members their positions, was ignored. They continued to be the go-to talking heads for the former Obama administration, hell-bent on destroying the current Trump administration, and they're taking the country down in the process. The Secret Service fears confrontation with the White House staff and handles complicated staff and Secret Service conflicts through the PPD management and White House operations chains of command. But if the White House chief of staff or the president were to instruct his team to be more accommodating and less confrontational with the Secret Service and to include them as workplace equals during advance work and not subservient security guards, the rank-and-file agents would likely be more comfortable coming forward and disclosing breaches of conduct that they've seen on foreign trips. Many of the Secret Service agents I remain in contact with have told me that the Trump administration has been taking steps to work with the Secret Service and to improve the information flow and working relationship between the members of the presidential bubble. It is comforting to hear that President Trump's operations staff within the White House has begun to open up to a more prominent advisory role for the Secret Service. Maybe then, with this new and more cooperative model, the Secret Service can begin to bury the troubled past with prior White House staffs and move forward with a less obsequious posture. This would ease the wow factor when working as a PPD agent in the White House and would encourage more responsible decision-making, not subservient behavior designed solely to avoid conflict with Secret Service protectees and irresponsible White House staff members. Chapter 10. The Broken White House Security Plan. The 18-acre White House complex is a dual security threat. Both the physical building, located at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and the President of the United States, who both works and resides inside the building, are top-tier targets for terrorists, hostile state actors, and psychologically disturbed individuals. Few buildings in the United States have been attacked as often as the White House. It has been attacked from the sky, during the 1994 Cessna crash on the South Lawn, from the north side, during the 1994 SKS rifle attack on the North Grounds, and from the south side, during the 2011 sniper attack from Constitution Avenue. In addition, in just the past 2 years, two intruders, Omar J. Gonzalez and Jonathan Tran, both mentioned earlier, made it onto the White House grounds on both the north and south sides, respectively. Gonzalez made it all the way to the state floor of the east wing of the White House before being stopped by an off-duty Secret Service agent. The White House is a magnet for attacks, and the main obstacle to appropriately securing the facility is that some of the White House stakeholders insist on treating the White House as a museum rather than as the most threatened government office building in the world. Making changes to the security plan at the White House is a complicated process because nearly every inch of the building is bound to a piece of history that someone is attached to and someone is convinced should be preserved. And while no one in the Secret Service I'm aware of is suggesting anything as dramatic as a complete redesign of the external grounds of the complex, they would likely meet heavy resistance if they were to put a substantive plan on the table to significantly modify the White House grounds to protect against today's threats. The White House was designed to house the president in a far different security environment from the one we live in today. It wasn't uncommon when the White House first opened in the early 1800s for visitors to walk directly up to the front door of the building, and both East and West Executive Avenues were open to pedestrian foot traffic. Pennsylvania Avenue on the north side of the White House grounds was open to horse and buggy traffic, as was the area now encompassed by the 52-acre White House ellipse. But although there have been significant security upgrades at the White House since its construction, the upgrades are not enough to fix the security problems. The White House is in both a challenging location for security, Washington, D.C., and within a challenging location within that challenging location, the business center of Washington, D.C. The White House needs a dramatic security overhaul of its external perimeter to mitigate the growing threat of an organized tactical assault on the grounds. And thus far, Secret Service management has not been able to force these changes. Here are some changes the Secret Service should immediately seek to implement at the White House to enhance its security footing. 1. The Secret Service should stop tinkering with the current White House fence. With the exception of the new anti-climb spikes added in 2015 to the top of the fence has not undergone any significant changes since 1965. The current White House fences on both the north and south sides of the White House will do little to stop an organized terrorist assault team from penetrating it and making way to the White House front and back doors. The White House fence was designed to stop people from walking onto the grounds, but it was never designed to withstand a blast from small-yield explosives or a strike from a vehicle, and both the Secret Service and the terrorists know this. The Secret Service made a small effort to combat the threat of an organized assault at the White House fence line in April 2017, when they announced that the South Grounds fence line would be closed, and pedestrian foot traffic would only be allowed on the north side of the ellipse. But this policy, although well-intentioned, will do little to stop an organized terrorist tactical assault team from assaulting the fence line. To prevent this, the Secret Service must start over and tear down the White House fence. It's a relic from a different era, littered with different threats, and it is an open invitation for people looking to do our president harm. In its place, the Secret Service should install an aesthetically pleasing double fence, wired with vibration sensors, to detect movement, and angled outwards, which would make scaling the fence nearly impossible. The double fence should have enough distance between the two fences that uniformed division officers and K-9 teams can patrol the area and respond to threats rapidly. The fence should be high enough that, in conjunction with the angling outward of the fence, it should prevent scaling and the use of ladders to bypass it in an attack. And although no fence would withstand a blast from higher yield, heavier explosives, the fence should be sturdy enough at its base to maintain some semblance of structural integrity in the event that a group of terrorists employs explosives in an attempt to breach it. Tearing down the current White House fence and replacing it with a more technologically advanced fence, with some of the specifications I mentioned, will provide an enormous tactical advantage to the Secret Service when, not if, the White House is attacked by a committed team of heavily armed terrorists. 2. The Secret Service Uniformed Division should consider turning the Uniformed Division Foreign Missions Branch over to the State Department and immediately reassigning the Foreign Missions officers to the White House. The Secret Service's troubled history with mission creep has also impacted the Uniformed Division. The early 1970s expansion of the Uniformed Division's, then known as the White House Police, mission to include foreign diplomatic missions was a misguided one. The Secret Service provides unparalleled value to the American taxpayer in fulfilling its core mission, keeping the President of the United States safe and secure. And in a normal business environment, this would be known as a core competency. But the Secret Service has always had a difficult time resisting the urge to expand its portfolio of responsibilities for reasons already discussed. Expanding the uniformed division mission to include securing foreign diplomatic missions does little to support the core mission of the Secret Service, which is keeping our president safe. The State Department has a budget far larger than that of the Secret Service, ranging from approximately $40 billion to $58 billion, depending on whether you factor in funds applied to overseas conflicts. The Secret Service's budget is approximately $2 billion, a fraction of what the State Department is allotted for overseas conflicts alone. The boldest way to solve this problem is to rid the government of the alphabet soup of federal law enforcement agencies, intelligence agencies, and inspectors general, and to combine assets from the different agencies into a larger but more efficient federal law enforcement operation, where none of this jockeying for funds and responsibilities would be an issue. But I don't see this happening anytime soon. Lawmakers think small nowadays, and their interests are largely in re-election and parochial items. The boldness of our founding fathers has escaped this generation of politicians, who preferred to remain on the ship while it's sinking, rather than fix the leaks. In addition to the lack of political will to course-correct the Secret Service among the political class, the uniformed division would likely resist giving up the responsibility for foreign diplomatic missions as well. Contrary to public perception, working at the White House is not a sought-after assignment within the uniformed division. Most officers would much rather be assigned to the foreign missions branch of the uniformed division, where they can engage in patrol and actual police work. Uniformed division officers assigned to the White House are largely relegated to fixed posts, which forces them to stare at walls and doors all day. After the allure of working at the White House wears off, which can happen after a few long, boring days there, most of the officers want a break from the monotony. The Foreign Missions Branch has been that break because it allows the officers the freedom to police the areas around the foreign missions facilities and to do what's in their hearts, be cops. But the Secret Service simply does not have the manpower for this expanded role any longer. By dropping the Foreign Missions Branch responsibilities altogether, they could free up personnel for reassignment around the 18-acre White House complex, where many of the officers could be permitted to roam and patrol, and to break up the monotony of fixed White House posting. But there's another obstacle. The White House complex and the surrounding streets are a political hot potato when it comes to police jurisdiction. Governments are experts at creating unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles, and the White House policing plan is no different. As the plan currently stands, there are multiple federal and local police agencies that have their hands in the security plan surrounding the White House. This would prevent the uniformed division from reallocating foreign missions branch officers to patrol roles in and around the White House. The Washington, D.C. Metro Police Department, the U.S. Park Police, and the Secret Service Uniformed Division share policing jurisdiction in the areas surrounding the White House, and these agencies would likely hesitate to give up their piece of the security pie. Whether an incident happens in the White House, on the sidewalk to the White House, on the streets surrounding the White House, or in the parks on both the north and south sides of the White House, is determinant in deciding which of these law enforcement agencies has jurisdiction. Do you realize how absurd this is? Having a stew of law enforcement personnel, although dedicated and committed to their missions, surrounding the White House with different training, different weapons, different cultures, and different communications infrastructures is outrageous and a lesson in government inefficiency. Here's an easy trade for lawmakers and the Secret Service, which I have no illusions will happen because it's too simple and the changes would hardly benefit any congressman's re-election campaign. The Secret Service gives up foreign diplomatic missions security, and in turn, the jurisdiction for security of the White House, the surrounding streets, and the parks on the north and south sides of the complex are turned over to the Uniformed Division. This would finally give them the ability to do the police work around the complex that they crave and have specific expertise in. 3. The Secret Service should expand the emergency response team, the K-9 team, and the counter-sniper team presence at the White House. One of the bright spots for the Secret Service Uniformed Division is their special teams. Although the special agent workforce and the Uniformed Division officer workforce rarely interact outside of the White House and the Vice President's residence, I've worked closely with many of their special teams members while doing advance work for Presidents Bush and Obama. Uniformed division officers assigned to the K-9 and counter-sniper teams will routinely travel outside of Washington, D.C., with the special agent advance teams from the PPD to assist in securing presidential sites both within the United States and overseas. I have always been impressed by the skill and work ethic of the members of the Uniformed Division's special teams while conducting security advances. The K-9 unit dogs and the Uniformed Division officers were always impressive in their ability to adjust to complex work environments. Dogs don't adjust very well to time changes on long overseas security advances, and many of the K-9 team personnel had to learn to be diplomats in some majority Muslim countries where dogs are not allowed in certain locations. Even on the most difficult of assignments, a visit to a foreign capital city with multiple high-rise buildings, which is a sniper's paradise, the counter-sniper team's work product was always timely and appropriate to the threats. The Secret Service has some of the best counter-snipers in the world. They routinely train to neutralize targets out to thousands of yards and under difficult weather conditions. The Secret Service counter-sniper team uses a JAR as their primary weapon. And in case you're thinking that JAR stands for something sophisticated, it stands for Just Another Rifle. Although the rifle is customized to fit the bodies of the technicians using them, officers assigned to the counter-sniper team are called technicians, they are Winchester Magnum bolt-action rifles, not dramatically different from the commercially available version. In addition to the counter-sniper teams, the Secret Service deploys the Emergency Response Team, ERT, on the grounds of the White House. The ERT is the Uniformed Division's version of SWAT, and the officers assigned to the ERT must meet rigorous physical fitness and firearms proficiency requirements. The personnel assigned to ERT are some of the most skilled and tactically proficient officers the Uniformed Division has, and their footprint should be dramatically expanded on both the north and south lawns of the White House. The physical and firearms capabilities of these elite operators are far superior to those of ideologically driven but generally poorly trained terrorist assault teams. And as for any concerns that an expansion of ERT Uniformed Division personnel would make the White House look like an armed camp, this is nonsense. The White House North and, to a greater degree, South grounds have a multitude of places where ERT Uniformed Division personnel could patrol and dodge in and out of view of the public, which is always watching on the fence line. If the Secret Service ever combines an expansion of ERT personnel on the grounds of the White House with an expansion of the number of counter-sniper team personnel assigned to watch the skies and the surrounding buildings around the White House, and an expansion of the number of K-9 units around the 18-acre complex, then a terrorist assault team even considering an attack on the White House had better factor in massive casualties on their part first. 4. The Secret Service should double the special agent personnel assigned to evening and overnight shifts on the PPD when the president is in residence. An organized terrorist tactical assault on the White House is likely to happen in the evening hours, when the enemy can take advantage of the low light conditions and the inescapable physical fatigue that accompanies overnight work. Relatively simple changes to the special agent work schedule, combined with a substantial increase in the number of special agents assigned to the PPD, which is more likely to happen if the Secret Service forfeits some of its current investigative responsibilities and frees up a portion of its workforce for reassignment to the PPD, would allow the PPD to shorten overnight shift posting requirements by increasing the number of agents available for relief and tactical support in the event of an attack. Overnight shifts are also an ideal time for agents on their downtime to familiarize themselves with the unbelievably complex White House grounds. To stay alert on overnight shifts at the White House when I was assigned to the PPD, I would walk the grounds, open doors I had never seen before, peek behind pillars in the Rose Garden, and generally familiarize myself with all of the hidden details of the White House. The White House is full of surprises, and not everything a person sees at the White House is as it seems, even for tourists on the East and West Wing tours. Increasing the number of agents on evening and overnight shifts would give the PPD agents a number of golden opportunities to create mental maps of the complicated layout of the White House. This would turn complexity into a tactical advantage for PPD agents familiar with the cover and concealment options around the White House, rather than a hindrance, as it was on the night Jonathan Tran scaled multiple fences on the White House and Treasury complex grounds and remained undetected for 17 minutes. 5. The Secret Service should take advantage of the presidential travel schedule and occasionally use the White House during out-of-town trips for training exercises. The White House is a complex building with a labyrinthine interior. Expecting the special agents of the PPD and the uniformed division officers to respond in a manner tactically suitable enough to repel an organized terrorist assault team, while simultaneously preventing them from rehearsing the response to an attack on the actual White House grounds, is both illogical and dangerous. And although building a replica White House at the Secret Service Training Center in Maryland for training purposes was briefly proposed in 2015, there was little legislative support on Capitol Hill for the multi-million dollar expenditure. But there's no replacement for the real thing. And no replica White House, however realistic, can provide the valuable training experience that training exercises conducted on the White House grounds would provide. There are, however, some complications to using the White House for training. The Secret Service would have to close the north and south fence lines for the training to prevent the public and potential adversaries from taking note of their training response to specific simulated emergencies. Also, the White House staff members left behind to work at the White House, while the president travels out of town, would be slightly inconvenienced. But the experience of repeatedly navigating around the actual White House grounds during stress-inducing training exercises under simulated emergency conditions would lend the Secret Service White House personnel an incredible tactical advantage in a firefight. There is no substitute for knowing your terrain better than your adversary, and training at the White House is the only way to build this body of tactical knowledge. The Secret Service, despite its many organizational difficulties, can reestablish security dominance at the White House, and while the list of changes I proposed is by no means exhaustive, it's a small but positive start towards a more stable security arrangement at the White House. The country cannot afford a second-rate security plan in a first-rate threat environment. The terrorists are surely planning, as you hear this, to hit us at the White House, and it's incumbent on the Secret Service to hit back with a fury. Chapter 11. The Broken Secret Service Hiring and Promotion Process. There are few things Washington, D.C. politicians and entrenched bureaucrats agree on. The 1980s ushered in a new era of electoral competition between the Democrats and the Republicans. Before then, the Democrats were the majority political party in both the House of Representatives and the Senate for most of the post-World War II era, while the Republicans had adopted a mostly play-nice strategy to stay politically relevant. And with that new competition for majority party status came increased political belligerency toward the opposing party when they were in power. But even with political tensions currently at redline levels, you would be hard-pressed to find any member of the House